China sends warplanes and ships toward Taiwan, while President Biden and Chinese President Xi hold a call to discuss the simmering tensions between the two nations. China expert and president of the Population Research Institute, Stephen Mosier, is here with analysis and his new book, The Devil and Communist China. And distinguished law professor and former U.S. ambassador to the Holy See, Marianne Glendon, gives us an insider's look at the last three papacies in her brand new book, In the Courts of Three Popes. The World Over begins right now.
Now, Raymond Arroyo.
A warm welcome to all of you joining us in the United States and the world over. If you'd like to comment on tonight's show, send me an X post. I'm at Raymond Arroyo. Let's get started. Pope Francis is making headlines this week in yet another book-length interview, this time by a Spanish journalist. The Pope praises the late Pope Benedict XVI, but he isn't quite as kind to Benedict's former personal secretary, Archbishop Georg Ganswein, and African Cardinal Robert Sarah. About Ganswein, Pope Francis says, quote, "He has turned me upside down by saying things that are not true. It is very sad," end quote. As for Cardinal Sarah, the former prefect of the Congregation for Divine Worship, Pope Francis says, quote, "At times, I have the impression that working in the Roman Curia made him a little bitter." Francis also maintains that Sarah was, quote, "immediately manipulated by separatist groups." He doesn't say which separatist groups. Pope Francis also brings up the conclave of 2005 that elected Pope Benedict, saying he, Bergoglio, was used during initial voting to try to block the election of Ratzinger. "It was a complete maneuver," Francis said. "The idea was to block the election of Cardinal Joseph Ratzinger. Though participants in the conclave are normally bound to secrecy," Pope Francis says in the interview that popes have license to tell it. The Pope's recent memoir, Life, another interview where he goes into detail about his personal history and how they clashed with headlines at the time, it has dropped off the New York Times bestseller list. We'll have more on all of this next week with a papal posse. Meanwhile, President Joe Biden and Chinese President Xi Jinping met by phone this week. The White House hasn't released details, but called the conversation a check-in between the two leaders. But almost immediately, fallout from that check-in, dozens of Chinese warplanes and naval ships were spotted around the island of Taiwan. What was gained by the phone meeting, and is Chinese action against Taiwan coming sooner rather than later? Here with analysis is the president of the Population Research Institute, author of the riveting new book, The Devil and Communist China, From Mao Down to Xi. Please welcome back to the program, Stephen Mosier. Steve, before we get to the book, I need your impressions of this phone call between Xi and Biden this week. We don't have detailed reports, as I mentioned. They discussed apparently climate change, AI, the Russian-Ukraine conflict, and Taiwan. And no sooner was the call finished than we saw those reports of military planes and warships around Taiwan, obviously coordinating a display of force. What have you been hearing about the subject matter of the call? And what does the massing of Chinese military assets tell you about China's intention toward Taiwan?
Well, China's intentions toward Taiwan remain what they always have been. That is to say that the Chinese Communist Party is determined, as it was under Mao, so it is under Xi Jinping, to recover the island of Taiwan by force if it does not simply surrender. Well, the people on Taiwan don't want to surrender. 75% said that they would actually take up arms to fight any communist invasion. I'm not sure what the phone call accomplished. I'm certain of one thing, though, Raymond. If the phone call had accomplished anything, if there was any sort of agreement reached, even a verbal agreement, we would be hearing about it. It would be shouted from the rooftops. The fact that they're only saying we had a sober discussion, a serious discussion about a number of topics, means that both sides agreed once again to disagree. We are fundamentally at odds with the People's Republic of China. And in their view, at the end of the day, only one country will be left standing. We need to keep that in mind.
Janet Yellen, she is in China this week. Secretary of State Anthony Blinken is scheduled to make a separate visit soon. Now, Yellen's message, part of it, in addition to what you just discussed, I hope, is that China is overproducing goods, particularly clean energy goods that the world can't absorb. Do you believe China's going to suddenly stop production of electric vehicles and batteries that this administration has created, mandated a market for?
No, absolutely not. And the Chinese Communist Party several years ago picked 11 different areas, high-tech areas, that they were going to subsidize. And electric vehicles and solar panels and so forth are part of that package. The Chinese Communist Party provides huge subsidies to these industries, which is why they overproduce goods and undercut the market everywhere. They sell these goods overseas, in some cases, Raymond, for less than it costs to manufacture them. And remember that when you're talking about manufacturing solar panels in eastern Turkestan, what China calls Xinjiang, you're talking about basically using slave labor of Uyghur right. Muslims to produce the solar panels in environmentally hazardous conditions. That's what the Chinese Communist Party is sending around the world. And that's what I'm afraid, as long as the U.S. government keeps paying them to do so by subsidizing the importation of these things, that will continue.
Yeah. China continues also to curtail freedom of religion within its borders. In March, we heard reports of a new national security law in Hong Kong, what the communist government is now calling treason. Now, this law could threaten the sanctity of the Catholic confessional in Hong Kong. Tell us what that would imply.
Well, the law requires anyone in Hong Kong, as the law in China itself already requires, for anyone who has any information that concerns national security or lawbreaking, to report it immediately to the authorities. So it's not just as if you can voluntarily go in and report to the authorities that a foreign national is spying or that someone has stolen something. It's that you have a positive duty to report anything that you think may be a crime. And it's intended to set everyone against everyone else. It's intended to isolate people in individual cells of fear so that everybody becomes an informer for the government in the same way that in Eastern Germany, for example, under the Stasi, half the population virtually were informants of the state police. The Chinese Communist Party would like to turn everyone in China into an informant so they could have everyone watching everyone all the time in real time.
Steve, operating under that still secret Vatican-China agreement, we still don't know the full details of, the Holy See recently sponsored a dialogue between Taiwan and Hong Kong as the church prepares to issue official rules on the engagement with Confucianism. Now, Steve, what's the goal of this dialogue first within China and within Taiwan? And why is this of more concern to the Vatican and the Holy See than the persecution of Catholics?
You know, that's a very good question, because the Chinese Communist Party, from its very beginning, has done its best to kill and to destroy Confucian thought, which, of course, was part of the governing ideology of China for 2,000 years. So Confucianism in China today is basically a dead letter. So I don't know why the Vatican is looking a century in the past to revive an ideology that's no longer practiced in China itself by the vast majority of the Chinese people, and to which the Chinese Communist Party is overtly hostile to. Instead of concentrating on helping Catholics in China, millions of Catholics in China now are under pressure to join the Patriotic Church. Priests and bishops under pressure to join the Catholic Patriotic Association. And the most heartbreaking thing I've heard came from an underground bishop who recently said, in the past, he said, when we were persecuted, arrested, put under house arrest, sent to prison, we at least knew that we had support in the Vatican. Now we don't know where we stand.
Let's discuss your brand new book, The Devil and Communist China. You trace China's current version of totalitarian communism back to Chairman Mao Zedong. But the ideas, the tactics employed by Mao, they came from somewhere. In the introduction of your book, you write, the use of terror as a tool for political control continues in China to the present day. Mao's ghost can be seen at work in the genocidal attacks on the Uyghurs, the persecution of the Falun Gong, and the insane COVID-19 lockdowns of entire provinces. The communist system that Mao created in China, inspired by Marx, weaponized by Lenin, and exported to China by Stalin, continues to devour large numbers of victims to the present day. How can you make a revolution without executions, Lenin decreed? And people have been dying by the millions in China ever since. Steve, I guess my question is, in that report you cite, or in your book you cite, the total death toll from the 20th century communism approached 100 million. China topped the list with 65 million of those deaths. You think those numbers are underestimated. Why?
Well, I do. Well, first of all, I add to that number the tremendous number of people who were killed during the Chinese Civil War when the Red Army was told to cut off cities from food supplies and hundreds of thousands, if not millions, of people starved to death. I add to that total the number of people who were killed by Chairman Mao using a borrowed knife. That's a Chinese expression, Jie Dao Sharen, using a borrowed knife. When did he use a borrowed knife? Well, whenever he was in a factional struggle within the Chinese Communist Party, he would betray the leader of the other Red faction, the leader of the other Red Army contingent, to the Nationalists, so they could be killed by the Nationalists. He did the same thing in the Korean War. He sent Chinese troops into North Korea to fight against our troops in Korea, who had just surrendered, who had come over from the Nationalist side, who surrendered at the end of the Chinese Civil War, and 250,000 of them were killed. Killing with a borrowed knife. So he was very good at that. Then there's the land reform, millions of landlords and rich peasants killed, all of the anti-rightist campaigns of the 1950s, the 50 million people who died in the famine from 1960 to 1962. And I have to tell you that Chairman Mao was one of the coldest, most calculating and callous people who ever existed on the planet. Because when tens of millions of his fellow countrymen were starving to death during the famine from 1960 to 1962, which he caused, by the way, he said, deaths have benefits, he shrugged. He said, they make good fertilizer. Now, he thought of his fellow Chinese as nothing better than fertilizer. The deaths continue. The deaths continued throughout the Cultural Revolution. And I hold him responsible for the one-child policy. Why? Because in 1958, 20 years before the one-child policy began, he declared, we need to control the production of people the way we control the production of steel and the production of bicycles. We need an office of state planning of births. And that's exactly what happened 22 years later when I was in China.
In the book, you say there are lessons to be learned from studying the motives and actions of Mao and his successors. You add that this book is a cautionary tale about the evil that awaits us if we abandon God and embrace evil. I'll read this little bit. We must not only recoil from Mao's embrace of satanic thoughts and practices, which brought death to the Chinese people, but also deliberately move in the opposite direction toward the life-giving truths of Jesus Christ, who is the truth incarnate. Now, Steve, I mean, the challenge there is, how do you get there for the Chinese people? I mean, they don't really have access to pure Christianity. The Bibles are being expunged of Jesus Christ and replaced with Xi and the regime. So how do you get there?
Well, I think you get there eventually by the grace of God. And in the meantime, we tell the truth in season and out of season. And that's the one thing the Chinese Communist Party is fearful of. It has actually published a party directive saying that the two threats to continued communist rule are a truthful accounting of Chinese history under communism and a truthful accounting of the ideology. Why? Because the history is a fabrication. The ideology is a fantasy. The ideology is a fantasy that we're going to build heaven on earth. And instead, of course, Marxism always creates hell on earth, over which leaders like Xi Jinping are happy to rule. Remember that communism is a philosophy based ultimately on hatred of God and hatred of one's fellow man. And I'm not the first person to say that. And I would point out that Archbishop Fulton Sheen Chairman Mao Zedong, who probably never agreed on anything else, both agreed that communism was an ideology based on hate.
Near the end of the book, you touch on Pope Francis's secret agreement with China and the fruit of that agreement. And you also note the utter silence from the Vatican when it comes to China, the scandals and crimes of China, indeed the coddling of these bishops who are part of the Patriotic Association. And for those who are new to this, that's the government-controlled church. How detrimental do you think history will look back upon this Vatican-Chinese agreement?
Well, I think it's clear, and people in the Vatican have already admitted this as well, Raymond, that the Sino-Vatican Agreement, whatever good it did, is now a dead letter. Because not very many months ago, a new bishop of Shanghai was appointed without any consultation, apparently, with the Vatican at all. And months went by before the Vatican reluctantly recognized him as a licit bishop. And they did that because they said they didn't want to leave the flock in Shanghai without a shepherd. There's a question in my mind, of course, a real question about what kind of shepherd they actually got in that process. Mm-hmm. But clearly, the Sino-Vatican Agreement has not fulfilled its primary promise, which was that it would be used to fill the 40 empty sees in China, where all of those people, Catholics, in all of those sees were without shepherds. That hasn't happened. Almost all of those sees remain empty today.
Hmm. You say in The Devil and Communist China that Chairman Xi is the true son of Mao. How so? And how has that outward face of Chinese communism evolved from Mao to Xi?
Well, let's talk about Mao Zedong just for a minute, because Mao, it's very interesting, as a toddler, was consecrated to a stone god not far outside the village where he and his family lived. He was 3 years old. He was taken out, forced to kneel and kowtow before this stone monolith, which had a pool at its foot, but the local villagers thought was inhabited by a spirit. And he was rechristened at that time by his mother, the third son of the monolith, Shishan Yadze in Chinese, third son of stone. And he really did seem to have a heart of stone and have a diabolical influence, throughout his life. In every choice he made, when he was faced with a choice between good and evil, he almost invariably chose evil. When he was faced with a choice of achieving an end by doing the right thing or by deceiving people, he chose to deceive. It's as if he took delight in deceiving. Xi Jinping is cut from exactly the same cloth. Xi Jinping behaves in exactly the same way. He has modeled himself on Mao in all things. The personality cult, the exaltation of him as a kind of pseudo-deity. The statues are going up. People are singing his songs. People have to download the Xi Jinping app on their phone and read from the Xi Jinping scriptures every day so they know what the great Xi Jinping is thinking. So all of the ways in which Mao sought to elevate himself over the people, so Xi Jinping is following the same path.
Yeah. No, it's a good, aside from the costume change, there's not very much difference. The uniform for the business suit, but other than that, the tactics are really the same. And of course, Xi has brilliantly woven capitalism into this stream of communist practice and totalitarian control.
Well, it's very interesting that the dress seems to change depending on the audience he's addressing. If he's addressing the military, he wears a military uniform. Like a third world 10-point dictator. If he's addressing the people in some circumstances, he wears a Mao suit. But when he's meeting with foreign leaders, he will, of course, wear a Western suit. But he changes his dress for the occasion. And that, I think, tells you everything you need to know about Xi Jinping. He also is now following Mao down the socialist road to ruin. And what I mean by that is that after the devastation of the Mao years, people remember that Deng Xiaoping had the four modernizations. The West was invited in. We were invited in to open factories and help China advance. And we did gladly because we wanted to see the Chinese people's living standards increased. So a new class of wealth creators arose in the 1990s and throughout the first decades of this century. But their wealth put a target on their back, and now they are being persecuted and purged, and their wealth is being confiscated. The most dangerous place to be in the world today is a billionaire in China, because you can be arrested, tortured, and killed, and your money taken by the state.
We have been seeing, and I suppose this is a symptom in parts, of the reality that you're describing. There has been a huge influx of Chinese citizens immigrating through South America into the United States. Now, what do we know about these people coming across the border? And what do you think their motives are for being here?
Well, we know that there's a huge pool of money and people that's desperate to get out of China because the economy is in recession. The unemployment rate among youth may be as high as 40%. The government admits about half that, but the government statistics are laughable. So the money and the people want to get out of China. Now, the thing about that is you can't really leave China without an export visa, without a visa allowing you to depart the country, and a passport. Hard to get. So anyone who leaves China is leaving with the permission of the Chinese Communist Party. Now, last year, I understand that 37,000 Chinese came across the border, southern border, from Central America. They fly into Central or South America and then move northward with the flow. Now, I think some of those are economic migrants. They're simply seeking a better life. I think, however, the Chinese Communist Party would be foolish if it did not salt in that migration saboteurs, potential terrorists, potential spies, who would then go to the local Chinese embassy and consulate and get new IDs when they arrive in on our shores so that we don't know who they are. And I will tell you this, the Chinese government is not cooperating in helping us to identify who these people are. So we have no idea who these tens of thousands of people are and what they might do, for example, in the event of a conflict over Taiwan.
Wow. Before we run out of time, I have to ask you about a recent controversy that really arose through a report that you were a part of concerning Catholic Relief Services. On March 6th of this year, your organization, Population Research Institute and the Lepanto Institute, published a 130-page report summarizing your findings of a joint year-long investigation into Catholic Relief Services carrying out contraceptive and abortion activities in three African nations. Tell us, first off, what did you discover?
Well, first of all, I want to tell people this was a serious effort. I mean, this is a long report that took us a year to compile. It is not something we undertook lightly. It's something we undertook in fraternal charity, basically in response to pleas from African bishops, including Cardinal Sarah, whom you mentioned in this, who will mention in next week's program, who talked about the ideological colonization that's going on in Africa, along with Pope Francis himself. We found, in looking at Zimbabwe and Cameroon and Lesotho, three separate countries, we found multiple problems with Catholic Relief Services programs there. I'll only mention three. Let me first mention that CRS developed and used a manual with its own logo on the front page that promoted masturbation as a form of safe sex. Now, I think, believe we have a picture of this. The logo includes the logos of USAID, a PEPFAR, the President's Emergency Plan for AIDS Reduction, and also CRS. So there's that. The second thing I'd like to mention is that CRS, Catholic Relief Services, created health referral networks that included contraception promoters. That is, in the network that CRS created, there were groups that were doing contraception and doing chemical sterilization through IUDs and implants and Depo-Provera, and at least one abortion promoter whose very logo is an icon of a pregnant woman with an X through her belly. Now, I believe you have that to show on the screen as well. I find that logo very off-putting because it looks like by Xing out her child, she's achieving some sort of freedom, which she's not. If you're doing referrals to groups that promote contraception, abortifacient contraception, and even abortion, that, I believe, is cooperation with evil. The third thing I would mention that we found CRS doing, CRS was the prime implementer, the lead implementer of a program called DREAMS, which was designed specifically to ensure the increased use of abortifacient contraception. In other words, they were putting together a consortium of groups to which they would do referrals of girls as young as 10 years of age, who would then be encouraged to not just use condoms to prevent AIDS, supposedly, but also to use IUDs, implants, or Depo-Provera injections.
Well, Steve, how did your organization vet and confirm these findings?
We had investigators on the ground. We conducted extensive investigations online and then followed up with in-person interviews in all of these countries. Interviews, by the way, that took us several months to complete. And I would say, Raymond, we have been looking at CRS programs for the last decade because there have been repeated concerns brought to us by African priests and bishops about some of these mm-hmm. programs. So that's how we come at
this.
Yeah,
when I read the report, I saw there was an archbishop of one of the countries here that you were focused on who is supporting this and was concerned because he said CRS didn't notify us of what's happening in the country. In fact, they don't consult with us at all. Now, prior to the publication of this report, you and Michael Hitchborn sent a cover letter and a summary to every bishop and archbishop and cardinal heading a diocese in the United States. On March 8th, Bishop John Wester of Santa Fe responded. He's also a member of the CRS board. He condemned your report. He wrote, as a former two-term member of the board of directors of CRS and a current member of the Catholic Relief Services Foundation board, I can assure you that your findings on the ethical actions of CRS are in error. CRS has consistently sought the judgment of prominent, well-respected moral theologians in those activities that may have moral ramifications. In each case, the theologians assured CRS and us board members that there is nothing being done by CRS that is immoral or unethical. Your persistent persecution of this wonderful organization, which helps millions of people every year throughout the world, is deplorable. I pray that you might gain the prudence to cease and desist. That was Bishop John Wester. How did you respond to the bishop's criticism and his call to cease and desist? And have you heard from other bishops?
Well, we have heard from Bishop Strickland. And in the past, in response to our reports, we've heard from other bishops, such as Bishop Sheridan, now no longer with us. But we will not cease and desist telling the truth. That's why I'm here, Raymond. That's what my purpose in life is. It always has been. And telling the truth got me fired from Stanford 35 years ago. I'm not likely to stop now. And I will not stop repeating what Pope Benedict XVI said in his motu proprio on the service of charity. He said specifically, in particular, the diocesan bishop is to ensure that charitable agencies dependent upon him do not receive financial support from groups or institutions that pursue ends contrary to church teaching.
There's certainly a lot of unanswered questions, and I mean, that 130-page report does detail some activities that need answers, I think, particularly now. And the letter did avoid answering any of the particular charges leveled here. And that accounting does, I think, need to happen. The Devil in Communist China, From Mao Down to Xi by Stephen Mosier, is available now at bookstores everywhere and online. Thank you, Steve. She is the former U.S. ambassador to the Holy See and the Learned Hand Professor Emeritus of Law at Harvard University. She's here to share with us her new memoir, In the Courts of Three Popes, an American lawyer and diplomat in the last absolute monarchy of the West. Please welcome back to the program Marianne Glendon. Marianne, thank you for being here. So delighted to see you. I want to start with your being appointed the first woman to lead the Holy See's delegation to that UN Beijing conference on women in 1995. Now, I remember covering the Cairo conference just before this, and the Holy See really took on the United States over abortion and contraceptive policy. Before you leave for that conference, John Paul II told you that you would be a voice for the voiceless, and then he gave you some advice. What did he tell you?
Well, one thing he said, presciently, was that if you run into difficulties over there, try going over the heads of the conference to the press. And that's exactly what we did at midpoint in the conference. You mentioned Cairo. The Holy See came to the Beijing conference with just the agenda that you mentioned. We wanted to speak for all the things that were needed for the most disadvantaged women in the poorest countries. And the European Union tried to make it into a replay of Cairo, the population conference. And we were determined not to let that happen. And so at midpoint, we just sent a press release to all the major newspapers in Europe, and we said, do you know what your European delegates are doing over here? Because the positions that they are taking are directly in contravention to many of the provisions of your own constitutions. And the next day, that was in the papers. It was giving rise to questions in the legislators, and the EU delegates eventually backed down, and we got back to business.
No, it was amazing. What was it like, Marianne, and for those who don't realize, you were the first woman ever appointed to head a delegation on behalf of the Vatican. What was that like? I know it couldn't have been all smooth sailing for you.
Well, you know, I think that it was part of one of the many things that John Paul II wanted to do during his time as Pope, and that was to not only speak about women, as he did on so many occasions, but to model a certain way of dealing with the roles of women and the roles of the laity. And I think that modeling, not only by appointing me, but many other women to major posts in the Holy See, I think that was his way of communicating to bishops and priests all over the world. And he issued a famous letter at the time of Beijing where he said, I call upon all members of the clergy to reexamine themselves about their vision of women. And if necessary, as a demand of their faith, imagine that, as a demand of their faith to adopt more positive attitudes. And I think as a result, we have now generations of priests and bishops who, like John Paul II as a young man, who have grown up with women, went to school with women, had friends with the laity and women and men married and single in the laity. I think that that effected a great transformation in the church.
And Marianne, you go on to be appointed after the Beijing conference and before. I mean, you were on the Pontifical Academy for Social Sciences, Pontifical Council on the Laity, the General Committee for the Great Jubilee. You're even invited to the Synod for America, which I remember covering. And you recount our dear friend, Father Richard Newhouse, who was seated just in front of you at that synod, who said, not since that year in fourth grade under Miss Woodward have I experienced such tedium. How did that synod differ from the synods we've been seeing under Pope Francis?
Well, for one thing, everybody had a chance to talk. And everybody did talk. That's one reason why Richard said, I was sitting right behind Richard at that synod, and I could tell he was bored out of his mind. And he wrote that whole book while he was sitting there. It was a great exchange of ideas on the one hand, but on the other hand, you could sense already that there was a certain, I couldn't say what proportion, but a certain sense on the part of some of the speakers that the United States was to blame for much of what was going on in the world. And that was a kind of preview of attitudes that we would encounter later on.
You interestingly title each of the sections of your book, and of course it's in the title of the book itself, you know, it's in the court of John Paul II, in the court of Benedict XVI. How is it a court, Marianne? I mean, to the general viewer, they don't think of the Vatican as a court. But how is it a court, and how did you discover that?
I use that word very deliberately, because after a while of serving the Holy See in various capacities, I came to see that it was impeded in achieving many of its aims as an international actor and as the central government of the Catholic Church. It was impeded from reaching its potential by an internal culture. Let me say a little bit more. It was a court culture. It had remnants of medieval courts, but it also had a pervasive attitude of, how should I put it, an attitude of somewhat of relaxed attitude toward laws and rules. Let me put it that way. And my first hint of that was on my very first trip to the Social Science Academy, when I noticed that reimbursement for travel came in cash. This is 1994. Reimbursement in cash in little white envelopes on minimal documentation. And I said, and then, you know, as time went on, it came to me that most priests have nothing in their background and training that really equips them to manage the finances of a large organization or much less a sovereign state. And then add to that that the style of governing of John Paul II and Benedict XVI was to leave everything, the internal affairs, to leave almost everything entirely up to trusted subordinates. And sometimes that worked out very well, but at other times some departments and dicasteries became little fiefdoms. And so it was an unusual bureaucracy, the bureaucracy of an absolute monarch, but an absolute monarch who kind of created smaller monarchies. And that was a recipe for trouble, especially where finances are concerned. And it led to many scandals.
Yeah, and I want to get into that, Marianne, which you do in the book. But before I leave this topic, do you think that that court is stronger or more impactful within the Vatican today than it was even under John Paul and Benedict?
I definitely think that the greatest challenge for Francis and the greatest challenge for the next pope, whoever he is going to be the culture of the Holy See. It is immensely powerful. And we saw that. You know, Francis, when he became pope, to his credit, he immediately started attacking the financial problems. He brought in Cardinal Pell. And Cardinal Pell very sensibly said, okay, the first thing we have to do is have an external auditor to find out how things are. What's the lay of the land? And the auditor, Libero Morone, he no sooner got started when he was fired
off with his head.
Fired by the number three, very powerful then, Cardinal Becciu. And from that moment on, Cardinal Becciu resisted Cardinal Pell at every turn. And at that time, I was simultaneously serving on a commission to investigate the Vatican Bank. And we, too, we had a kind of general search warrant from the Pope himself. And yet we were resisted at every turn by the internal culture and the then president of the Vatican Bank. So this is going to be a big challenge.
Yeah, I want to get into that later because you do spend some good time in the book about that. And, you know, but it does speak to that, again, that courtly culture of as long as I'm in good standing with the king, with the monarch, all will be well. And I don't the rules are beneath me. And that really is how this apparatus continues to operate. But we'll get into that in a moment. I want to talk about something happier for a moment. While at a Vatican meeting, you get a call from Karl Rove. That President George W. Bush wants you to serve as ambassador to the Holy See. Now, you've been collaborating with the Vatican many, many ways, leading delegations on councils and pontifical academies. Any trepidation at that point when you got that call?
I have to say, I said, yes, I'd like to do that right away. no, I didn't.
Why?
If I had any hesitation, it would be, what would my husband think? But since it was only filling out an unexpired term, I knew my husband would be all for it. And I thought it would be a wonderful opportunity to see the Holy See from another perspective. And I did think mm-hmm. that having served in so many parts of the Vatican, that I would be able to be more effective as an ambassador in a short period of time. I would be able to hit the ground running, so to speak.
Yeah.
Now, you might say, well, you've been a diplomat for the Vatican and you're so involved in Vatican departments. Can you, would there really be a conflict of interest? But, you know, that's what we lawyers do.
Yeah, that's right. Well, look, and your appointment was blocked by a certain senator from Delaware, a Joe Biden, who people might know. He maintained that you had violated the Foreign Agents Registration Act. What was his gripe then, Marianne? And it was related to the work you had done with the Holy See.
Yes. Well, as the State Department lawyers pointed out to the senator, there's a specific exemption in that act for work done for a religious organization. So I think the real reason I was blocked was, I say nothing personal, it was simply that it was close to the election and he didn't want to approve any leftover nominees. And, you know, I wish that I could say, well, once they saw that, I wish I could say that the problem was solved when the Biden staff realized that there was an exemption covering me in the act. But in the end, I had to rely on my good friend, Ethel Kennedy, she convinced her brother that he ought to have a chat with me, and I explained the problem to him. And I said, look, we really should have an ambassador in place when Pope Benedict comes next spring. And miraculously, I was unanimously confirmed by the Senate the next day. So,
Teddy Kennedy helped push it over the top.
Yeah, it was solved the old Boston way.
Oh, yeah. Well, I look, Marianne Glengen gets it done one way or the other. I love it. Tell me this. You thought, because of your experience with the Holy See, that this would give you a leg up, if you will, and an ability to see it from a different perspective and hit the ground running. Is that what happened?
Yes, I would say it was. It was a period of very good relations between the United States and the Holy See. The previous disagreement over the Iraq war was ended because the Holy See was now worried about the consequences for religious minorities if the U.S. should suddenly withdraw. So that on an official level, the relationship was good. And then there was this surprising friendship between Pope Benedict and President Bush. They really liked each other. No one could understand it. They were so different in so many ways. But my theory was, at least in part, that President Bush, thanks in part to Richard Neuhaus, spoke Catholic, if you know what I mean.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that appealed to Benedict. In any event, they had this was unprecedented. They had three meetings in the space of a little over a year.
Yeah. What was the most difficult part of being ambassador for you, ambassador to the Vatican?
Well, this may seem trivial, but as I was told when I had the training period in Washington, forget about privacy. And I didn't really know what that meant until I got over there. And of course, I was used to going to Rome and freely walking around and enjoying the city. And it was a little disconcerting not to be able to move outside the official residence without two armed policemen. So I would say that represented quite a change for me as an academic to be so hemmed in.
Yeah. Tell me, what was the transition like? Because you had a front row seat. What was that transition like between John Paul II and Benedict? And what impact did it have on the Holy See itself? Neither, as you mentioned earlier, were great administrators. They kind of deferred that to others.
Well, it was a beautiful moment in a way. The funeral and Benedict's words, It was. I think anyone who was there or who saw it on television was astonished by what some of the things that happened. I mean, how it. Mm. We were sitting there, and the mass was coming to a close, and suddenly a gust of wind came along, and the Bible, which had lain open on the coffin of John Paul II, suddenly shut. There were thousands of people who saw that happen. It was just amazing.
Yeah, it was beautiful. It was a beautiful moment.
It was beautiful. And in some way, I think, we Catholics have been spoiled. We don't realize how lucky we were to have lived in a time when we had a pope who was both a philosopher and a major figure in the great events of the late 20th century, where we saw the seemingly indestructible totalitarian regimes fall. And then he was followed by another great pope who probably, I'll just guess here, probably someday will be considered a doctor of the church. It was an astonishing time. And I think, actually, one of the difficulties for Pope Francis, one of his challenges has been to come along at a time when he had to follow in the footsteps of really two giants, and it must have been difficult to be constantly compared with them. But if you look back over the whole history of the Catholic Church, if you read a book like John Julian Norwich's Absolute Monarchs, all the popes, there have never been two popes in a row like that.
No. No, it's a very rare thing in church history. I want to get to more of this later, but while we're on this topic, Pope Francis promised when he assumed the throne to reform the Curia. Indeed, that's why a number of electors elected him, to reform the inner culture of the Holy See itself. Has he, in your estimation? I mean, he's abolished the Pontifical Council for the Laity. He's appointed some opponents of life to the Pontifical Academy for Life. Your thoughts on his refinements of the Curia, are they refinements?
To his very great credit, when Pope Francis became pope, he acted immediately on both of those fronts. He initiated financial reforms and he initiated curial reforms. He showed his awareness of the problems that I call the problems of internal culture. When he gave one of his major speeches that year, he called it Diseases of the Curia. And he set in motion from the very beginning both immediate incremental reforms and a commission to prepare a new constitution, which went into effect in 2022. So I think on both fronts, the financial reforms and the curial reforms, he came up against exactly what I've been talking about, the strength, the power of an internal culture that had been left pretty much without oversight over almost 30 years. And I would say he initiated in both areas reforms that I hope the new pope will continue, but I hope whoever the new pope, I think whatever the new pope decides to do, he is going to come up against the power of that particular, that unique bureaucracy.
I can't let this pass. You mention in the book, you really deplore that Pope Francis abolished. I'll quote you. You say here at one point, his decision to abolish the Council for the Laity and to fold its responsibilities into a new dicastery for the laity, the family and life, was understandable as an economic measure, but it inevitably gave the impression of downgrading the importance of the bodies it replaced. You had to have a reaction to that. I mean, you wrote about it in the book. That didn't make you happy, watching that dissolve.
Sure. I was a member of the Council for the Laity for 10 years. But I have to say that I think we are going to see more of that sort of thing, because as of right now, the Vatican is in dire financial straits. It has a huge deficit, around $77 million. It doesn't have a plan to address that deficit. Income is down, donations are down, and that is why I think outsourcing has got to be part of the answer, and not a really difficult part of the answer. But I think there are more painful decisions ahead. And I think that the new pope is going to have to look at other parts of for example, I really loved the Pontifical Academy of Social Sciences, and I was its president for 10 years. I could see certain structural features that prevented the academy from reaching its potential. And I now think, given the fact that the best work in Catholic social thought really is being done in Catholic institutions, colleges, and universities around the world, I now think that one of the first institutions to be reexamined just from an economical point of view is going to be that academy.
But, Marianne, you mentioned there about the financial malfeasance that has happened over time. Donations are down. I mean, a $77 million deficit. My question is, don't you see that attached to the vibrancy of faith and the commitment to faith of the people who've been making those donations? I mean, isn't that why you have this deficit? It's not just misspending of money. It also is you're losing your audience, right?
Absolutely. Absolutely. I think the prestige of the Holy See has been badly hurt in a number of ways. I think the next pope has to worry not only about finances, but about the kind of reputational damage that has taken place, a kind of sense of, I think they're going to be looking for a pope who will speak with more clarity and consistency on matters of faith. And I think they're going to be looking for a pope who will be, let me put it this way, mater et magistra, someone who can. So I remember what Bill Buckley said about that, and everybody probably will remember the same thing. Mater si, magistra, no. But I think that the conclave will be looking for someone who will speak out strongly in terms of Catholic social teaching. I think that they're looking for someone who will speak out clearly on matters of faith. And I think they're also looking for someone who'll take care of the house.
Yeah. Well, this Vatican Bank disaster, and you had a front row seat at watching this thing. I mean, the director, the deputy director were convicted of embezzling tens of millions of dollars from the bank. There was this atmosphere of fear. And as you said earlier, you all went in with a warrant, and it was a broad warrant from the Pope. What did your investigation discover? And I don't want you to get into all the intricacies, but in general, what did you discover? And was anyone listening to your findings, Marianne?
Well, we interviewed two of us, a bishop and myself. We interviewed nearly every one of the 115 employees of the Vatican Bank, and they were terrified, even though we had in the papal document, we had absolute guarantee that nothing would go beyond Bishop Arrieta and myself. They were terrified of speaking to us, of saying anything to us. And that in itself was data, that this atmosphere of fear in the Vatican Bank. And as far as corruption is concerned, of course, that whole story is well known. And I was able to report to Cardinal Pell when he arrived in 2014 about the internal situation at the Vatican Bank. I think there are still problems, problems of morale in the Vatican Bank. The Vatican Bank has certainly made some progress, but I'll just tell one story, which is a matter of public record, that imagine this. This is the new board of directors of the Vatican Bank. And I arrive that year, I think it was 2014, I arrive as one of the new directors. And there were only five of us at the beginning. It is a small board. Mm-hmm. And a month after I meet my colleagues, one of them goes on trial in Germany for financial felonies. This is the reform board.
It's unbelievable.
How does that happen?
And then you've got the auditor general is fired by the Pope with Bechu's instigation. You've got Cardinal Pell sidelined. I mean, there's multiple factors here that led to this corruption, Marianne. And I mean, it does run to the very top of the organization. It's not just the guy, the teller at the window, or the guy, you know, filling out the audit sheet.
Well, the teller at the window became president of the bank, and he himself is is a problematic character.
I know you believe the laity is being called to a special moment here, particularly as we move toward a new papacy. You've seen the news where the Pope has appointed, Pope Francis, a special study group to report to the Synod this fall on holy orders for women after it was declared and settled by the last two popes that this was a no-go. I want your thoughts on this now, and what should the role of women be in the church going forward?
I think that the role of women, I think discussions of that question tend to focus too much on church officials, and they let the laity off the hook. It is my impression that most bishops around the world are perfectly well aware that they need the services of laity with particular skills, that the laity, men and women, can enable priests to do what they're trained to do, what they do best, and what they were called by God to do. I think the new generation, now a few generations of priests and bishops, are very alive to that fact, very open to that fact. And I think there's too little talk about the responsibilities of the laity. We, after all, are the ones who are supposed to be primarily responsible for the transformation of the secular sphere. And how many of us really take that to heart? How many of us even attend to our formation in the sense that we actually, many of us spend more time learning about information technology than we do about how to answer Peter's question, give a reason for the faith that is in you.
Yeah, the conversation also, whenever women come up, it is now being diverted into talk of holy orders and ordination and allowing women on the altar, which when you look at the mainline churches that have followed this path, they're empty or dying.
I think that's going down the wrong path. I would say, what is the primary vocation? When we're baptized, we have a vocation to holiness and a vocation to mission. How are we in Western countries, we Catholics, men and women, how are we living up to that second thing, that what our Protestant brothers and sisters call the Great Commission? In 2033, that's a millennium, a jubilee of the Great Commission. I don't think we Catholics are measuring up terribly well. So I don't see how seeking more clerical roles for men or women solves the problem, the real problem, the one that Cardinal Newman taught us to worry about, how to be fulfill the church's mission in an increasingly secular world. I put more responsibility on the laity than I would on the church officials.
Marianne Glendon, well, thank you for modeling for so many people what lay involvement in the church can look like, both as a mother as well as a representative on so many levels. In the Court of Three Popes by Marianne Glendon is available now at bookstores everywhere and online. Marianne, thank you for being here.
Thank you, Raymond.
That is all the time we have for now. Be sure to catch us next week. Until then, we'll be scouting the world over for all that is seen and unseen. On behalf of the staff and crew of EWTN News, I thank you for watching. I'm Raymond Arroyo. Bye now.